Good morning, and welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. In this part of Focus, we'll be talking about why it is that human beings have language and other animals do not. Now, that's not to say that animals cannot communicate. At least, they can communicate with others of their species, and when it's very important, they can do that. In some cases, it may indeed be a matter of their survival. However, there is nowhere in nature where there is another species that has a system of communication that is as complex, with the capacity to express so much in so many varied ways, as human language. So the question is, why? We'll see if we can provide some answers this morning as we speak with Terence Deacon. He is a researcher in the field of neuroscience and also evolutionary anthropology. He works in his laboratory at Boston University, where he is associate professor of biological anthropology, and also at McLean Hospital at the Harvard Medical School. And he's authored a book on this subject, which is available now if you would like to look at it. We'll be talking about it this morning. The title of his book is The Symbolic Species, The Co-Evolution of Language and the Brain, and it's published by W.W. Norton. And he suggests that, in fact, the brain and our language abilities developed together. Another way of saying it is that we did not develop language because we had big brains, that perhaps we have big brains as a result of the fact that we developed language, and that that process took place over a long period of time. We will discuss some of the ideas in the book this morning and would be very happy to take whatever questions or comments that people have. We ask only people be brief if they can, just so that we can include as many different callers as possible. But everybody's welcome to take part in the conversation. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL or 9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-WILL. So if at some point here you'd like to join in the conversation, give us a call. Professor Deacon, hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks, and thank you very much for talking with us.
Yes, I appreciate having me on.
Well, let's start talking a little bit about when we talk about human language and the differences between the way humans communicate and the way that animals communicate, what really the difference is? Because I think that, if you started to engage people in a conversation about what language is about and what has to happen, someone might say to you, well, what really language is all about, what has to happen for language is that you have to be able to understand that there are objects, there are all these things in the world, and that we have names for those things, and that you have to understand the association between the name, the fact that we have this we have this red round fruit that grows on a tree, and we have this collection of symbols, APPLE, and it's pronounced in a certain way, and that those two things correspond to one another. And I suppose then someone might say, well, you know, animals can do that too. We have a cat at our house, and he knows what treat means. So isn't that sort of the same thing? And I know the answer is, well, there's a very significant difference there between those two things. But what really is the difference?
Because to some extent, that's a question that's dogged philosophers for two millennia. And really up to the present time and up to the time I wrote my book, a lot of ways that question had been evaded, because it's easy to say, well, indeed, when I tell my dog, let's go for a walk, he jumps to the door, he's all excited, he knows what to expect, and so on, and the same with your cat and treats. The correspondence, the sort of one-to-one mapping of one stimulus to some other that's not present, is something that almost all sophisticated animals can learn. Though most animals don't use that kind of thing very widespread in their communication, it's still something that can happen, and we can train animals in very complicated ways to do that. We now know, of course, that there are also calls and gestures and things that animals produce that also have this capability that they develop from birth. Some wonderful examples involve the honeybee dance, in which the way that the bee returning from foraging circles around in a sort of figure eight pattern provides information about the direction and how far away a particular food source is. Another wonderful example is vervet monkeys, who give different alarm calls when the troop is threatened by an eagle or a leopard, because, of course, you have to escape from those animals in very different ways. So we're very familiar with that kind of reference, the way that things point to other things. The problem is that although language does that as well, although there is a correspondence between a sound and, say, something in the world, it's a very much more complicated or, in fact, fundamentally different kind of correspondence in other ways as well. And the best way to see that is to think about a dictionary. Because in a dictionary, we realize that words not only point to things in the world, they point to each other in very complicated ways. And in fact, it's that kind of second level of pointing, of words mean other words, in a sense, that tells us something about the difference. And I call that difference symbolic. It's a term that's been bandied around a lot to refer to that. But I think that's the crucial difference. As a result, we're able to represent things in the abstract. We're able to represent things that are impossible. We're able to represent the future or possible futures or alternative possibilities, even things that we've never had experience of, like electrons or quarks. We all bandy these terms around, and we've never seen these things.
So it's not just the simple one-to-one correspondence between the object and the symbol that represents it, but what we're talking about is the fact to work simply in the realm of symbols and have them understand and manipulate their relations one-to-one.
That's right, and I think that is really crucial, and although we sort of take it for granted, it's one of the most obvious and widespread features of our lives. Yet we don't have a good explanation of how that happens. And one of the major tasks in this book was to say, well, if we don't understand this, we're not going to get very far with this question of how it originated. So we better go back to basics and try to take it apart and understand how it works and what those differences are. In fact, that question was really driven home to me when some kids asked me a very simple question, at least it seems simple on the surface, and that is, well, if language is such a complicated thing and only humans are able to do it, what about simple languages? Couldn't you construct a really, really simple language with just a few words and a couple of rules? And then anybody'd be able to learn it, my cat, my dog, a parrot, whatever, and be able to communicate just perfectly normally. That stumped me, because all the reasons that I had read that people had come up with that explained why we have language, which were mostly things like it's very complicated and you need to be very smart, or grammar is so messy and mathematical in its structure that it must be built into the brain before we start, all of those wonderful explanations for why we do it and other animals don't answer the question that these kids posed to me. They don't answer the question of why animals then don't have simple languages. Throw out the complexity. But if you throw out the complexity, then there's nothing left to explain why they don't do this, except this one troublesome little fact, that words mean differently than, say, a laugh means what it means or a sob means what it means.
When one thinks about why it is that humans have language, or perhaps what it is that's necessary for humans to have language, I guess one of the first things you start doing is looking at the differences in brains between humans and other animals,
right,
and look for differences. So you might seek for explanation in the complexity and the organization of the organ that does the thinking. And in human beings, we do have this a certain part of the brain that is more highly developed than it is in other animals, that seems to be the place where the higher functions are located. And you talk a little bit about how you've got to get past just simply the idea that sheer size is important, or the relationship between the size of the brain and the size of the body, because there are plenty of examples that would help us say, well, that's really not it. There has to be something more fundamentally different in the brain, how it's constructed, how it's organized, But you also say that, you know, rather than it's sort of a chicken egg business here, you know, rather than saying, well, we somehow had these big brains that were that predispose us to language and that it developed that way, you're suggesting that, in fact, perhaps we that we have the brains we have because of language and that the two things developed together.
Right. And I think that's probably one of the most novel conclusions that I've drawn from this work is that, in fact, you don't need to sort of build in a special accident that made it possible or some other general function like intelligence that simply gets to a threshold where it's possible. In fact, if you look at the structure of the brain, and this is what really drove me to this in the first place, it's very hard to identify a distinct difference that is really unprecedented. Though the brain is much, much bigger in proportion to the body in humans as compared to any other primate, there are no new parts, really. You can define new parts in sort of subtle ways, but for the most part, everything has a precursor, as it does with every other part of our body when you compare us to other primates. But what I did notice is that it was not just a general enlargement. There were structural changes and rearrangements. And it seemed to me that the most curious difference in our behavior, language, ought to correlate with the most curious differences in the structure that produces them, the brain. And so in trying to map those two questions together, I converged upon this problem, the problem of how you acquire symbols. And probably the most divergent features of the brain have to do with the proportions of the front part of the brain, the prefrontal cortex, although the entire cerebral cortex and some other structures seem out of proportion with respect to each other. This one structure seems particularly out of proportion. And what struck me about that is that that's a part of the brain that's very crucial to do things that we call working memory tasks and associated with things that we might think of as insight learning, although I think the term is an oxymoron. I think of insight as being something very different than learning. But I realized that this had a lot in common with the problem of why symbols are so hard to acquire and why other animals struggle with them. And perhaps this change in size changed our cognitive style, so to speak, changed the proportions of the different computations that we tend to run in our brains to make this problem a more tractable problem for us.
Our guest this morning, a neuroscientist, Terence Deacon, and we're talking about the development of language in humans. He's written a book on the subject. The topic, or the title, is "The Symbolic Species." It's published by W.W. Norton. He is an associate professor of biological anthropology at Boston University and at McLean Hospital at Harvard Med School. He does work in both those places. And questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll free 800-222-WILL. I suppose that all. Another factor that makes the business of trying to understand what is going on in the brain when people use language and what parts of the brain are important, we, of course, now have the kinds of technology that makes it possible to look at the brain while a living person is functioning and to look at what parts of the brain seem to be active and then from there to think about, well, you know, what does that mean for what parts of the brain do what sorts of activities, and that one of the things that you see when you have people do various sorts of language tasks is that there is no one place. You can't really point to a spot in the brain and then say this is the language place. That it's somehow much more complicated than that, and that different parts of the brain do different sorts of things and work together in different sorts of ways to make this all possible.
Well, you know, I always come back to a statement I read in a book, just a novel, that if the brain were simple, we'd be too simple to understand it. And in fact, the story with language shouldn't have surprised us. It would have been a surprise if there was one special structure, like a special chip in a computer, that did it all and was just sort of plugged into the brain. But it's much more biologically sensible to recognize that language is something that the whole brain does. There are parts that are much more crucial to this function, just as there are parts that are much more crucial to the movement of my index finger and my right hand. But what we find with these imaging studies, and it's opened up a remarkable new vista on the working brain, what we find is that not only are many places in the brain involved, but that it may change from time to time with just subtle changes in the task that we're doing, the kind of word association task, for example, that it involves, or whether we're talking about nouns or verbs being recalled, or whether these are nouns about animate or inanimate objects. Remarkable differences in these subtleties of language, suggesting that really a large part of the brain is involved in this process. And they're not just even motor mouth areas and auditory areas, but visual areas, tactile areas, and so on, may all be playing part of the mnemonic role in organizing these functions. This tells us that language has been sort of adopted by a brain designed to do something originally very different, to lead a primate life without this sort of thing. Hmm. And what's happened is the brain has been recruited, and areas that are most appropriate to these particular subtasks of language have been recruited differentially to do this. This is not a simple process because language is so different than what other species tend to do in a lot of ways. But it does tell us something very interesting and something that we should expect from the biology of it all, and that is that the logic of the way language is organized is probably not the logic of the way it's laid out in the brain. It's laid out in the brain according to the logic of the way neurons work, having to do with timing and input-output information and so on. So that we shouldn't expect it to be laid out as a grammar area, a sentence area, a word area, and so on. Mm. It's going to be much more complicated.
Well, I suppose that that also leads one into another sort of controversy, and that is the relationship between the brain and language. You know, one of the things that people have always commented on and marveled at is the ability of children to learn language.
Absolutely.
And the ability of any child to learn the language of the people that you happen to put that child with. And so that the people that led people to sort of theorize, well, that there must be some set of common rules about language that they all follow, even if it may take a lot of thinking to find out what they are, and that the brain is somehow wired, it's somehow hardwired to take to use that set of rules and then apply them in different ways. You really suggest that it's not, you know, this business of why it is that people take to language, it's not really in their brain. It's not really that we're wired for it. It has much more to do with language itself, and that it's almost, you know, we have sort of a trial and error kind of process that we take as we learn the language. So it's much more out there than it is in our heads.
Well, I do take that perspective, but I want to be clear that there's no question that we humans come into the world predisposed to learn language. The controversy is not so much whether we have some inbuilt predisposition. We must, because other species don't do this so well, and we do it so remarkably well with such complex languages. The question is how that's implemented. The most extreme views of this, suggested by linguists and philosophers, are that the rules of language are in some sense built in, like a sort of memory in the computer when you buy it that knows how to do certain things already before you put any programs into it. We don't have to learn it. It's like an instinct. In fact, Steven Pinker, one of the modern proponents of this view, following ideas of Noam Chomsky as well, has suggested that it's built in to the brain the way nest building is built into a robin, for example. They do it without thinking. They do it automatically. Robins all tend to do it about the same way with the same kinds of things. To some extent, that's got to be right. But the question is, how much can be built in, what kinds of things? And my perspective on this is that a whole series of biases for learning language clearly are built in, but the actual structural information for language is almost certainly not. There's reasons why it can't be, in part because it is symbolic. A rule that says that this kind of thing is a noun and this kind of thing is a verb is a symbolic thing. And just like word meaning, which is symbolic, it's not something that you can come into the world with. It's something that you have to learn because of its complex way of referring. The question then becomes much more difficult, because then we have to ask, why do children make such good guesses? Why are they such good learners? And the problem with this question is that they're very good learners and good guessers about language at the very time that they're very bad at learning other things. It's hard to teach them the names of cities or streets or the presidents or how to do simple mathematics and so on and so on. In fact, they're very distractible, they don't like to memorize things and so on and so forth. And yet they do this apparently really complex thing. That's a paradox, and I think a paradox that needs answering. My approach, as you've intimated, is to recognize that it's not just what's inside and the biases that are inside our heads that are relevant, but in fact that you have to think of language almost as a sort of organism that, in order to get passed on from generation to generation, has to be reproduced in children's minds. And under those constraints, you realize that languages are under incredible need to adapt, so to speak, to children's brains. That is, in a sort of social evolutionary process, languages that are difficult to learn, structures of language that are difficult to acquire, are unlikely to be passed on. Those that are most easily acquired and most easily picked up, especially by young children who can really build it into their brain, so to speak, by learning, are going to be much more likely to survive over time. My suggestion there is that, in fact, languages have evolved in time, historically even, and continually evolve to be most learnable by immature minds, adapted to the very limitations that they exhibit. And we haven't spent much time looking at what those features might be like.
Line number two.
Yes, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Good morning.
My question is, could you discuss the relationship, if any, between the ability in humans to develop a sort of an abstract model of their environment based on their perceptions and their memories particularly, and how that plays off the development of language and how they sort of use language to accumulate more information and to pass information out and sort of test their environment?
Right. I think it's a very good question. In fact, we do know, of course, that other animals have models, so to speak, of their environments. They know what to expect. They know what's coming, what's likely to happen following certain events. It's not that we're the only species that's capable of modeling the environment, even in a somewhat removed way from ourselves, thinking about the future and the past and so on. But clearly, the ability to refer to things in a much more abstract fashion allows us a lot more freedom in this regard. It allows us to recode a lot of the information that we've acquired by rote, so to speak, by example and by experience, to recode it and mix it with a lot of abstract information. So I know a lot about parts of the world I've never visited. In fact, I'm learning a lot about the cosmos, which I never will visit and probably can't really conceive of realistically. And yet, we talk about the Big Bang, we talk about the possibility of planets on others, around other stars, and so on and so forth. That kind of capability is, of course, only possible if you're capable of representing things in the abstract. So I think that what it does is it creates a radically different world, and I call it a sort of virtual world, to parody the computer age ideas of that. But I think there's another sense of a virtual world that's equally important about our environment, and that is because of this ability, we're also able to represent other people, not as objects moving around that have possible actions that are going to affect us, but also what they're thinking, what they're feeling, what they might do, what they love, what they hate, and so on and so forth. We can imagine what it's like to be in somebody else's shoes. In fact, a good part of the arts industry is about helping us to do so and helping us to get all kinds of varieties of experiences of imagining what it's like to be someone else. A very powerful capability that I think is very, very minimal in other species because they don't have this representational ability. That's another part of this virtual world that in some ways is vastly, vastly larger and broader in scope than any other species has access to.
Do we know how we're coded for that, or is that still one of the items under contention?
Well, my sense is that it's not something independent from this capability. Certainly we know that children, for example, begin lives with a very idiosyncratic and person-centered, self-centered perspective. I don't mean that in the negative connotation, but simply that it's very hard to take another's perspective. For example, sitting across a game board, can you tell me what it looks like, or, you know, whether this piece is on your right or your left or which hand you'd use. Children under the age of about 3 to 4 have trouble with those kinds of transitions, taking the other perspective. Perhaps our endless fascination with mirrors comes out of that. That tells us that these capabilities are still developing, and they develop with our language, with our symbolic capabilities. And our symbolic capabilities develop continually beyond the point that we've developed our relatively sophisticated language as we learn the complex interrelationships of words and concepts about concepts, and so on. So I generally don't think there's anything special about our sensory capabilities or imaginary capabilities in that sense, except that they're augmented by this symbolic capacity.
Thank you very much.
All right, thanks. Well, this business of being able to manipulate symbols and see them in relation to one another, upon which language depends, is this essentially a memory task, a very sophisticated one, but essentially is that really what it's all about, or is it more than that?
Well, I think it is both that and more, and I say it's that certainly because one of the things that symbols allow us to do is to recode the way we remember things. When I try to remember something in my past, it's very easy for me to use time and date to organize those memories, to use that to find out where I was, what I was doing at that time, what would be most likely, and so on. It's a very nice filing cabinet system, for example, so that I can go back and chase down those flags and find out what's where. That certainly augments memory. But I think that the very process of making the transition from one kind of reference, what I will call indexical reference, the kind of thing you say, this is something I learned by rote, is typically what we refer to as indexical reference. Something that it's called indexical because it's associated with pointing at things, indicating things. And symbolic reference, which is this more abstract form, is indeed to some extent also a recoding of memory at the very basic level. Because a word represents something else, or a sentence represents something else, by virtue of an indirect relationship to those objects. It represents it by virtue of its relationship to other words, other concepts, in combination. And by virtue of that, we're able then to indirectly refer to a lot of things in the world. That indirect reference is a recoding of memory, and I think that that, in fact, is the difficult problem. How do you learn to recode? What kind of information is sufficient to tell you that this relation of reference that you're trying to learn is one that's going to require you to learn something and then forget it again to recode it in a new way? So that we're using the brain, using memory in many of the same ways, except that there's this recoding step in the middle that transforms the relationships into indirect relationships.
Well, let's talk with someone else. We have a caller in Aurora, line number 4. Hello.
Hi. Language is always so fascinating. I was always interested to see how some people can learn 4 to 5 foreign languages, and some other people can't even handle one.
Right.
And I just wondered, what is it in a person that gives them the ability to learn foreign languages? Is it the interests, the capabilities, where they live? Like in Europe, it's almost a necessity because you live so close to other nationalities and do business with them that you have to learn the languages.
Well, I think all of those are, of course, going to be factors. Need is very crucial in all of this. But there are other factors that people have identified as well. The age at which you became exposed to more than one language is very, very important. It looks as though, in most cases, and this is not entirely true for all people, but in most cases, when you're younger, it seems simpler to pick up more than one language at a time. As we get older, we tend to learn them in a less fluid, less flexible way, and in ways that are easily forgotten, so that when children are exposed to multiple languages when young, they seem to do a better job of it. One possible clue as to what's going on in the brain that might make some people more easily adaptable to this sort of thing is that it looks as though different languages in bilingual or polylingual individuals tend to be represented in the brain somewhat independent of each other, separately. We know, for example, that damage to the brain in later life can cause loss of language, but in people who are bilingual, sometimes it can affect one language, not the other. That suggests that something about the capability of separating these tasks, running them sort of independently in different parts of the brain, might be crucial to learning to use other languages effectively. And of course, we all feel this indirectly when we try to translate one language to another in order to talk in a foreign language. It's much slower and more cumbersome. It's always easier if you sort of automated it and separated them so you don't have to do the translation step. There's even a more interesting example of this that's been identified by a research group in Italy that suggested that people who learn to do simultaneous translation, that is, they listen and speak, hearing one language and speaking another language, such as necessary in the United Nations, for example, are actually able to shift the placement, the location, the use of their brain as they learn to do this well. And this tells us, I think, the crucial fact about the problem, and that is that languages compete with each other for use of the brain, for our attention. And we do a better job of processing more than one language when we set them apart from each other so that the competition is minimized.
I just wanted to say that what you said about being younger and learning the language, I just get such a kick out of watching the young kids speak Spanish, and they just laugh about it, and they joke about it. I mean, it just is no problem to them, and they seem to enjoy it and joke about it, and it's just very comical.
Yeah, it's certainly apparently much easier. It's one of these things that I have always struggled with myself as a young adult, trying to pick up another language and losing it almost as soon as I've learned it.
Do we then learn, can we learn the Romance languages, all those categorized as being Romance, easier than learning, like, Swedish or Finnish?
I'm not sure that that's true. It may well be that in learning a language that's quite similar to your own, they actually compete more effectively with each other than one that's quite, quite different, though I don't think there's been any real good evidence one way or the other on that. What I should say about young children, and it's very important about understanding the role of the brain in all of this, is that in early development, brains are much more plastic and flexible. Something we, you know, recognize with old adages like you can't teach an old dog new tricks. Though not completely true, it is the case that very young brains are capable of much more substantial rewiring in response to experience than our older brains.
I think they make a game of it, and it's fun for them.
I think that's right. I think, you know, one of the other interesting things that you mentioned about different languages is that we do know that young children very early on are capable of picking up and recognizing and distinguishing the distinct sounds that each language uses, but not all languages use the same sounds. And it turns out that after a few years of life listening to one set of sounds, children become relatively less able to even hear and distinguish the phonemes, the sound units of other languages.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
This has been classically demonstrated in languages like Chinese and Japanese that lack some of the liquid vowels like R and W and L, because they don't have the ability to distinguish those. They're not distinguished in that language. But this is true in many, many different language groups. Children specialize after a certain point so that they stop listening for and indeed lose the ability to distinguish some of these sounds. So those of us as adults may have a great deal of difficulty picking up the sounds of a language that's quite different than our own.
Thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. There's another matter here that you address in the book. I want to make sure that we talk a little bit about, and then we'll get to some other callers. And that is why it is. You know, what were some of the forces that worked for language to develop? You know, why it is that the brain, these areas in the brain, were somehow recruited to take on this task that in primates they just didn't do. What was it that human beings were engaged in? What sort of activity? What business of social organization made it necessary or encouraged this development of language to occur?
Well, in some ways, I think this is the most troublesome problem in all of this, in part because all of those events are not available for us to explore, whereas brains are at least available to explore. And so we're left telling stories about that on the fragmentary evidence we have from our fossil past. But I think there's even a more basic problem with that question, and that is especially brought to the fore with my approach, which suggests that symbolic communication in some form must long predate the appearance of modern languages and have co-evolved, as I say in the book, with the brain and helped push the brain in a certain direction, because that perspective requires that at some point in the past, a species very much like modern chimpanzees in their abilities to do language-like tasks had to have been the first to acquire some of the rudiments of a symbolic communication system. The question we need to ask at that point is that we're now talking about, in fact, a simple language-like system, a simple symbol system, and we are thrust back on that first question I ask, why don't animals have simple symbol systems? There are lots of reasons they don't, lots of learning reasons, and the way I would put it is it's a fairly counterintuitive thing to acquire because it's so indirect. But the real key question then becomes why one species alone crossed this very difficult threshold and others didn't. No others did. One species in millions and millions and millions of years. And I think it's even more difficult if you get rid of the complexity issue. Because if I was just able to make the claim that language is a better, more complex communication system, then it would be easy to say, well, almost anything could take advantage of a better, more complex communication system, and I could say that things like gossiping, like hunting, like taking care of immature babies, like organizing large groups, all of those things could have helped language along. But we see those things, of course, in other species. The real question is, why shift from a very good communication system, calls and gestures, to something as cumbersome and complicated as symbolic reference? Once you ask it that way, there's only one way to approach it seems to me, and that is you have to ask the question, what can symbolic reference alone supply that no other form of communication can? Even if the symbolic communication is incredibly clumsy and cumbersome, and these other systems are quite developed, which is the case for most animal communication. And I think the answer there has to be that it's the unusual nature of the reference, again, that's crucial. What is it that required symbolic reference? What is it about our past? And symbolic reference, of course, has the ability to refer to things in the abstract, in the future, the possible. And so I fall back on the problem of what is it about early human development that might have required us to publicly communicate about the possible. And I think we're reduced to going back to an almost Rousseauian argument. That is something about what you might call a social contract, a promise. The ways that human beings cooperate seems to be crucially dependent upon being able to represent possible futures, possible alternatives. Will you still be around if? Will you still be my friend if? These are very crucial things in human lives. And I think they're most crucial and most pointed with respect to reproduction. That is, organizing who will mate with whom. And after that process, who will care for whom? Who will be responsible for whom? Every human society doesn't just mate, but engages in a complex contractual organization of mating and reproduction we call marriage. It may be quite different in different societies. It may be monogamous in some societies and polygamous in other societies. But there's always some contractual arrangement between family groups. I think that process, the process of organizing reproduction in a cooperative, contractual manner, is the crucial problem. And I think it was brought about by the problem of organizing to get meat, bringing it back, providing it in a reliable way to women and your offspring who are unable to go out on forage in a place where there's lots of predators, easily able to pounce on your babies. That's a very complicated problem socially. It's a complicated problem because we have a deep-seated desire continually erupting to break those relationships down as every soap opera drives home daily.
We have about 5-6 minutes left. We have a couple of callers. We'll see if we can get them in the time that it remains. Next, we'll go to Chicago, and it's line one.
I really appreciate the encyclopedic breadth and depth and scope of your presentation. Very, very much, both of you. And question is relating to Paleolithic mankind. A book referred to what was manner of communication before, say, language actually became formulated, and they made reference to a possible mental telepathy that might have been in existence. Do you give any credence to that?
Well, the truth is, I know nothing about mental telepathy because I know of no evidence for it, a lot against it. Obviously, we have to keep our minds open about these things. I don't know how it would work. But assuming that it's not a major part of our life today, it seems to me pretty unlikely that it was a major part at some point in past. It's not something that I can answer from a scientific point of view, unfortunately, because there's just, as far as I can tell, no clear evidence to help us out.
Except the anecdotal experiences that people have remarked and having.
But unfortunately, that's the nature of science, is that we have to be very careful about anecdotal stories. Science is based upon accumulating evidence and evidence corroborating other evidence. And that's what's so very hard to do in this sort of circumstance. I can't entirely rule out the possibility that some future time we might discover some vestige of the capability to communicate irrespective of physical actions that we engage in. But to my knowledge, there is no what I would call scientific, and that means repeatable.
Right. Well, things like deja vu and other things come to mind. But
You know, there's all sorts of these experiences in our personal lives that we think might be, but it's so hard to pin them down.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah.
All right, to Peoria, line number two. Hello.
Good morning. I enjoyed that last description of the beginning of language there.
Thank you.
I had a question about this theory that suggests that language somehow shapes the way we perceive reality around us. Are you familiar with...
There's a lot of theories like that. The classic one is by a man named Benjamin Lee Whorf. And he argued, in fact, that languages were radically different from one another. And we find oftentimes, for example, terms that we just can't interpret in another language. I mean, you know, we oftentimes borrow the terms from one language just to keep those going. I think of je ne sais quoi from French that you try to come up with an English description that accomplishes the same kind of meaning. But the strong view of that was that, in fact, language changes the way we think of the world, and there are a lot of people who consider this as a possibility. I think it must be true at some level. And this is just the opposite of the universality claims. There's certainly lots of evidence that at least grammatical structure and a lot of semantic structure has a great universality across human groups. Even things like the reference to color terms is remarkably consistent from group to group. Even though colors, you know, could be anything in the rainbow, people use a term to refer to almost the same frequency of red wherever you go in the world, even though they use different words to do it. So there are clearly universals. The question still remains, how strongly does our language, does our conceptualization bias us to some worldview? I don't think we have a solid answer of it. I do think, however, in a general sense, that just simply being symbolic biases the way we look at the world. And I often think of the problem of ends. I talk about this a lot in the book, in fact, the idea that we expect the world to have a purpose, a goal, an end to it, or that my life has a purpose, or that the universe has some sort of intelligence behind it. We have a great deal of trouble understanding that, you know, life might just cease for me at some point. All of these are issues of me reading purpose into the world. Purpose, of course, is something that symbolic systems create. Meaning of things is something that's symbolic. I doubt that my dog worries about the meaning of life.
Well, I guess where I get a little hung up is it seems that so we're using symbols to somehow create or define the real world.
That's
and
right.
That there's somehow...
Or at least to recode it.
A connection there of understanding or needing symbols to recode it or define it or describe it or to remember it.
The analogy I would offer is of the so-called idiot savant or the autistic savant, some individual who has perhaps relatively diminished IQ, on the other hand, has some remarkably well-developed and spared ability. The classic sort of popular example, of course, comes from the film Rain Man, where Dustin Hoffman portrays an autistic savant who has this incredible numeric ability to remember numbers and to see numbers so that when one of the characters spills a match box, he knows instantly by looking how many matches are there. What's happened is one spared ability, is one exaggerated ability, is how he relates to the whole world. Well, I think of that in our case. We have this remarkably overdeveloped bias in our cognition towards symbolic thinking. So we see the world in terms of symbols. We see the world in terms of categories, of types, of classifications, and, of course, of purposes, of ends, of intents. We see nothing as coincidence, but always the work of some sinister force somewhere in the background. And we're endlessly fascinated with cons and, you know, plots and so on and so forth. We're looking for meaning everywhere, even where it's not. And I think that's a very similar sort of thing. We use this one overdeveloped skill to do things probably way outside of the range that it needs to be applied.
Mm. Well, the topic is very, very interesting. I'm really sorry to say that we must stop, but we must because we're at the end of the time. I want to thank you very much, Professor Deakin, for talking with us.
Well, and thank you. It's been very enjoyable.
Our guest, Terence Deakin, and his book, if you would like to read it, is titled The Symbolic Species. It's published by W.W. Norton. Terence Deakin is Associate Professor of Biological Anthropology at Boston University.